Imagine a bank vault that is, just mathematically impossible to break into. The walls are like 3 feet thick of solid titanium, the biometric locks are completely flawless, and it's guarded around the clock.
Right, a total fortress.
Exactly. Yet somehow, thieves just walked away with $230 million from it.
Oh, wow.
And how do they do it? Because they didn't even try to hack the vault. They just hacked the armored car driving up to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the ultimate reality check, isn't it? You can build the most impenetrable fortress in the world, but if the roads leading up to it are compromised, well, your fortress is pretty much worthless.
It really is. And, well, welcome to today's deep dive, where we are talking about exactly that kind of reality check. We're unpacking a really fascinating stack of tech briefings from the June 1st, 2026 TechInnite reports.
And there is a lot to get through today.
Oh, for sure. Our mission today is to explore how the tech industry is finally and honestly painfully growing up. I mean, for the longest time, the whole mantra was move fast and break things.
Right, the classic Silicon Valley motto.
Exactly. But you can only build so many shiny new things before you have to just, stop and fix the cracked foundations you built them all on.
Yeah.
So today we're looking at how companies and communities are learning from the sins of the past.
Yeah. Fixing decade-old technical debt.
Exactly. Throwing out stubborn hardware strategies and just swallowing their pride to give you, the user, what you actually need.
And the shift we're seeing across these reports is, well, it's profound. Maturity in tech isn't just about chasing like faster processors or writing cleverer code anymore.
Right.
It's really about taking a hard, unfiltered look at messy real-world use cases, structural vulnerabilities and actual human behavior. It's this major pivot from raw, unchecked invention toward thoughtful, secure integration.
Yeah, well said. So let's start with how the industry handles its ghosts, specifically in the software and blockchain space. Because we have two wild stories here that perfectly contrast, where we were versus where we are now.
Oh, these two are fascinating, side by side.
They really are. First up, we've got a literal rescue mission from 2016, and then we'll contrast that with that massive bank heist scenario I mentioned at the top.
So the Hongcoin rescue, this is a story that played out over, what, nearly a decade?
Yeah, 10 long years.
To set the stage for you, back in 2016, a project called Hongcoin launched an initial coin offering, or an ICO. The idea was super simple. Investors send in Ethereum to fund the project, and if the project doesn't hit its minimum funding goal, the smart contract.
Which is just a piece of self-executing code, right?
Exactly, yeah. The contract is programmed to automatically refund everyone if they fall short.
Except, the project failed to hit its goal, and the automatic refunds literally never happened.
Right. And the crazy thing is, it wasn't a malicious rug pull or a scam, it was just a bug. Specifically, an integer overflow bug in the Solidity programming language.
No, man, those are the worst.
Yeah, and the really insidious thing about this particular flaw is that it didn't crash the system. It didn't throw up a massive red error message. It just failed completely silently. So for 9 long years, 1,003 Ethereum, which today sits at about, well, a $2 million valuation, just sat there, permanently locked in a digital vault that literally no one had the key for.
Okay, so for the listener who, doesn't write smart contracts on the weekends, let's break down what an integer overflow actually is. It's basically like the odometer on a really old car,
Right.
right?
Yeah, that's a perfect way to visualize it.
Like when you drive past 999,999 miles, the car doesn't physically break down and explode. The mechanical dials just run out of physical space and roll completely back over to zero.
Exactly. I mean, in a computer, memory space is finite. If you have a variable that can only hold a number up to, say, 255, and you try to add one to it, it doesn't just magically become
Oh, yeah, it
256.
runs out of space.
Yep, it overflows the allocated memory and wraps right back around to zero. In the early days of blockchain development, specifically in versions of Solidity prior to version 0.8.0, developers had to manually write extra lines of code just to check if this odometer rollover was going to happen.
And if they forgot.
If a developer forgot to write that manual check, the contract was incredibly vulnerable, and well, the Hongcoin developers forgot.
But the wild part of this report is what just happened on June 1st. A white hat hacker, a good guy going by the pseudonym 0xFlorent, actually managed to pull off a rescue.
Yeah, it's incredible.
He reverse engineered that decade-old contract,
Yeah.
figured out the exact parameters of the overflow, and essentially crafted a highly specific transaction to trigger that exact same bug again.
Fighting fire with fire.
Literally. But this time, he used the rollover to trick the contract into unlocking the funds and releasing them back to the original 2016 investors. I have to praise the white hat community here.
Yeah.
They act like the blockchain's volunteer fire department.
That's so true.
They're constantly running into burning digital buildings to save people's assets.
And the way Zerup Slorat handled it, it really shows how much the culture has matured. I mean, he didn't just drain the funds anonymously. He operated completely transparently. He coordinated with the original long-defunct Hongcoin team to ensure the rescue was legal and properly routed.
Which is huge.
It is. And furthermore, the underlying technology has matured too. If you write a smart contract today, modern Solidity has built-in overflow checks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it won't let the odometer roll over anymore. It will just safely halt the transaction. The language itself kind of grew up to protect developers from their own mistakes.
Okay, so the code got better and the old mistakes are being patched. But, and this is a massive but, as the base code gets safer, the financial ecosystems built on top of it get infinitely more complex.
Oh, exponentially more complex.
Which brings us to April 2026 and the $230 million hack. This is that armored car heist I was talking about.
Right.
Because the Hongcoin bug was a simple math error in an isolated standalone contract.
Yeah.
But the AV hack, that was an exploitation of modern interconnected complexity.
Yeah, and to really understand this, we have to look at AV3. It is one of the premier decentralized finance or DeFi lending protocols in the world. Exactly, the vault. And AV's own smart contracts are incredibly secure. They have been audited by top cybersecurity firms dozens of times. They are mathematically sound. So the attackers didn't even try to attack Arrive's code directly.
They didn't even touch the vault doors.
Not at all. They attacked the transit system connecting AV to the rest of the crypto universe, and it happened in four distinct stages.
Okay, break those stages down for us, because the mechanics here are just fascinating.
Sure. So, stage one. The attackers executed an RPC poisoning attack. This allowed them to manipulate the data feed of a single-point verifier on the Layer 0 bridge.
Wait, let's pause right there.
Yeah.
For the listener who doesn't live and breathe Web3 architecture, what exactly is RPC poisoning? Is that like someone hacking a GPS satellite so your car's navigation system tells you you're on a highway when you're actually driving into a lake?
That is actually a great analogy.
Yeah?
Yeah. RPC stands for Remote Procedure Call. It's essentially the communication protocol that allows an application to ask a blockchain for information.
Okay, so it is the GPS satellite.
Exactly. By poisoning it, the attackers fed false data to the bridge. Now, the critical flaw here was that the bridge relied on a single-point verifier.
Okay, wait. I am completely lost on why this was allowed to happen. You're telling me a multi-billion-dollar financial ecosystem was relying on a single verifier?
Yep.
I mean, isn't the entire philosophical point of cryptocurrency that it's decentralized? Why would anyone build a single point of failure into the chain?
Well, it's the classic trade-off between security and efficiency. Running a fully decentralized network of verifiers to check every single cross-chain transaction is slow, and it's wildly expensive.
Oh, so it was about saving money on fees.
Mostly, yeah. To speed things up and lower transaction fees, developers sometimes use a one-of-one decentralized verifier network. It's faster, sure, but as we saw, it becomes the ultimate Achilles heel.
Right.
Because they controlled that single verifier's view of reality, we get to stage two. The attackers sent a perfectly forged cross-chain message claiming that over 100,000 RCETH tokens had just been transferred from the Ethereum network over to the Arbitrum network.
Even though the tokens never moved.
The tokens didn't even exist.
Wow.
Which triggers stage three. The smart contract on the Arbitrum network received this forged message. And because the message had the correct cryptographic signature from that single verifier of the GPS system, it trusted the contract, blindly followed orders.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It minted over 100,000 counterfeit, completely unbacked tokens out of thin air.
Unbelievable. And then the grand finale, stage four. They took these freshly minted counterfeit tokens, walked them right through the front door of Alv, deposited them as collateral, and took out a massive loan.
Yep.
They borrowed tens of thousands of real wrapped Ethereum tokens and walked away with $230 million in genuine liquid assets. And they just left AV holding a bag of worthless, completely fake collateral.
And this right here is the paradigm shift for the industry. Adav realized immediately that they could no longer just audit a token smart contract.
Right, looking at the vault isn't enough.
Exactly. Following this hack, Ahav completely tore up and rewrote their listing standards. Before, they just looked at the token's code and its market liquidity. Now, They evaluate the overarching cybersecurity practices of the team.
Which makes sense.
They audit the bridges moving the token. They interrogate the oracles providing the price feeds. They're looking at the structural weaknesses of the entire underlying architecture.
So DeFi basically learned the hard way that a secure vault means absolutely nothing if the roads leading to it are compromised.
Totally.
They have to embrace practical, holistic solutions rather than just looking at isolated chunks of tech. And honestly, that exact same realization that you have to look at the messy real-world context and not just the isolated technology is hitting the hardware industry right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's pivot to what I call pragmatic power, starting with AMD's new graphics card, the Radeon RX 9070 GRE.
Ah, yes, the GRE, which stands for Golden Rabbit Edition. Originally, this was a card manufactured exclusively for the Chinese market, but AMD just surprised everyone by launching it globally at Computex 2026. They've priced it at $549. It uses their newest RDNA 4 architecture, it comes with 12 gigabytes of video RAM, and it is explicitly engineered and targeted for 1440p gaming.
And to really understand why this matters to you, the listener, we have to look at the current market context. I mean, think about the last time you looked into upgrading your PC.
It's been rough.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
You were probably staring at a $1,000 price tag, or even a $2,000 price tag, feeling completely alienated. NVIDIA is absolutely locking people into their ultra-premium ecosystem right now with proprietary tech like DLSS and advanced ray tracing.
Yeah, they really are.
Meanwhile, AMD quietly bumped the price of their standard RX 9070 up to $619. But this new GRE version, it's about 10 to 15% slower than that standard card, but it's $70 cheaper, bringing it back to that $549 sweet spot.
Right.
But here's my question. AMD is intentionally releasing a cut-down card while their main rival pushes the absolute bleeding edge of visual tech. Is catering to this, like, pragmatic middle class of gamers a winning strategy? Or is AMD just waving the white flag and admitting they can't beat NVIDIA on high-end performance?
Well, I wouldn't call it a white flag at all. I'd call it a highly calculated, good enough strategy. Let's look at the broader macro pressures here. The massive crypto mining boom, which artificially inflated GPU prices for years, is completely over.
Thank goodness.
Right. And on top of that, AI companies are buying up all the high-end silicon manufacturing capacity from foundries like TSMC to build massive data centers. And everyday gamers, they are just exhausted. They're tired of needing a second mortgage just to play a video game.
Right. I mean, the average person isn't buying a $1,600 graphics card.
Precisely. The vast majority of consumers buy in the $400 to $600 price bracket. By offering a card with 12 gigabytes of memory, which ensures you won't run out of texture space for modern games anytime soon, AMD is hitting the exact target where real volume exists.
Volume over raw power.
Exactly. Yes, if you put it on a benchmark chart next to NVIDIA's advanced ray tracing hardware, it loses. But for the pragmatic gamer who just wants to sit down, boot up a game at 1440p resolution, turn the settings to high, and get smooth frame rates without emptying their bank account, the GRE is an incredibly compelling piece of hardware.
They're focusing on what people actually do in their living rooms rather than what looks good on a corporate spreadsheet or a YouTube benchmark video.
Yes, exactly.
And what's fascinating is that Dell is taking a very similar reality-based approach with their new Alienware AW3426DW monitor, which brings us to the QD OLED revolution.
Oh, this is a big one. OLED displays have been the holy grail for a long time. The technology relies on individual organic pixels that generate their own light. Because they don't need a backlight, they can turn off completely, giving you infinite contrast, true perfect blacks, and virtually zero response time. But they have historically suffered from one massive glaring flaw.
They are incredibly dim if you use them in a bright room.
Exactly. Because the pixels are organic, if you push too much electricity through them to make them brighter, they overheat and burn out.
Which leaves those awful permanent ghost images on your screen.
Right. Burn in. So manufacturers have always had to artificially cap their brightness, but Dell's new 34-inch ultra-wide monitor aims to finally solve this physical limitation using a new panel structure called pentatandem technology.
When I was reading the engineering breakdown on pentatandem, I realized the best way to explain it is to think about urban planning.
Okay, I like this.
With traditional OLEDs, if you wanted the screen to be brighter, it was like a city trying to build a bunch of single-story houses. It's suburban sprawl. It takes up too much horizontal space, requires too much infrastructure, and it generates way too much heat.
Yeah.
But pentatandem is like building skyscrapers. Instead of spreading the pixels out horizontally, they're literally stacking independent red, green, and blue light-emitting layers vertically on top of each other.
Stacking them up.
Yeah, they multiply the brightness in the exact same footprint.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize the physics at play here. By stacking these organic layers vertically, they don't have to push massive amounts of voltage through a single pixel. They push a small, safe amount of voltage through multiple stacked pixels simultaneously.
And a result.
The result is staggering. This new Alienware monitor is hitting 1,300 nits of peak brightness, a 280 hertz refresh rate, and a 0.03 millisecond response time. They have essentially engineered away OLED's biggest historical weakness.
So you don't need to draw the curtains and sit in the pitch black cave to see your screen anymore.
Exactly.
But, you know, there is always a catch when we talk about pushing display tech this hard.
Oh, you're right.
For the listener who works from home and wants to use this for their day job, what's the risk?
Well, the risk is the reality of productivity work. Burn-in still remains a fundamental physical threat. I mean, Dell has implemented software tricks like pixel shift, which subtly moves the image around, and logo dimming, which detects static images and dims them.
Right, to protect the pixels.
But if you are a professional, say a coder, an accountant, or a video editor, you're staring at highly static elements for 8 hours a day. Your code editor's sidebar, your Excel spreadsheet grid, the Windows taskbar at the bottom of your screen.
Oh, yeah.
Those specific stacked pixels are constantly turned on while the rest of the screen changes. So over time, they will degrade faster than the surrounding pixels, leaving a permanent shadow.
So the technology is maturing, but it still has to respect the basic laws of physics.
Exactly. This is why traditional mini LED monitors, which use an incredibly bright LED backlight that can't suffer from organic burn-in, are still very much in the race for professionals. OLED is now the undisputed flawless king for gaming and watching movies. But if your real-world use case involves heavy desktop productivity, the industry still has to offer you an alternative.
That idea of hardware having to actually adapt to the physical realities of the people using it brings us to our final theme today. We are looking at two absolute titans of the industry, Samsung and Apple.
Yes.
And how they're being forced to completely rethink how technology physically fits onto the human body. Well, let's talk about our hands first and start with Samsung.
The foldable market is having a massive shakeup right now. The Galaxy Z Fold 8 Wide just had its first major real-world sighting.
Oh, the restaurant leak.
Yeah. A Samsung employee was actually spotted out in the wild, sitting in a restaurant in South Korea, actively using a prototype.
That's wild.
They had the device concealed in one of those bulky anti-leak cases, but the physical dimensions of the screen were unmistakable. The renowned industry tipster Ice Universe managed to share the spy shots, and they confirm a total design pivot for Samsung's flagship device.
They are completely abandoning the narrow screen. I mean, for 7 years, seven generations of this wildly expensive device, Samsung insisted that when the phone was closed, it needed this incredibly tall, skinny 23:9 aspect ratio.
Which was so awkward.
Using the cover screen felt like trying to type out a text message on a TV remote control.
That's exactly what it felt like.
Now, the leaked photos show they're moving to a much more balanced, standard 20:9 ratio. The cover display is jumping from 6.2 inches to 6.5 inches, and the inner tablet display expands out to 8.0 inches. And I have to say, looking at this report, this is a very rare, very humbling moment for Samsung as a company.
Humbling in what sense, though?
In the sense that they stubbornly dug their heels in on that narrow design. They insisted it was ergonomically superior for one-handed use, despite reviewers complaining about it for half a decade.
Right, they wouldn't budge.
But then real competition finally entered the space. Devices like the OnePlus Open and the Google Pixel Fold launched with wider, normal-feeling front screens. And the market spoke instantly. Users made it crystal clear. Having a normal, fully functional smartphone that opens into a tablet is vastly superior to having an awkward, cramped stick that opens into a square.
Yeah, the market forced their hand.
Samsung had to swallow their immense pride, abandon their design philosophy, and admit that their competitors were right.
And we really shouldn't underestimate the physical engineering required to swallow that pride. Making a folding device wider while also trying to keep it thin is a massive challenge.
I can imagine.
The reports indicate they've reduced the folded thickness down to 11.8 millimeters.
Oh.
To do that with a wider chassis, they had to completely redesign the mechanical hinge from the ground up.
Wow.
This new hinge is rated to survive 300,000 folds, which is a 50% increase from the previous generation's 200,000 rating. A wider phone also means a different center of gravity, a larger internal volume that requires a bigger battery, and entirely different thermal cooling pathways.
It's practically a new device category for them.
It proves that Samsung is finally willing to do the excruciatingly hard engineering work required to give consumers a form factor they actually want to hold in their hands.
So that's adapting to human hands. But what about adapting to the human face, which is arguably the most sensitive personal real estate a tech company could possibly try to conquer?
Oh, without a doubt.
This brings us to the final briefing, Apple's 2027 smart glasses strategy.
This is a monumental long-term business play. According to detailed reports from Bloomberg and The Verge, Apple is currently preparing to enter the global eyewear market by late 2027.
Okay.
They are developing a pair of lightweight smart glasses, specifically targeting a price point between $200 and $500, and it's designed to compete head-to-head with Meta's Ray-Ban glasses.
And if you look at their strategy, they are dusting off the exact same playbook they used to conquer the wrist with the Apple Watch.
It's a proven formula for them. I mean, let's look at the sheer scale of the number. Before Apple entered the space, the global traditional watch market was worth roughly $132 billion. Apple walked into that space, completely redefined what a watch was, and now they absolutely dominate it.
Yeah, they own it.
They bring in about $17 billion annually just from Apple Watch sales alone. Now, look at the global eyewear market. It is significantly larger, estimated at around $180 to $200 billion annually.
Because everyone needs glasses eventually.
Practically everyone over a certain age needs vision correction. Yeah. Apple is looking at that and deciding they want to do to your glasses exactly what they did to your watch.
Okay, I have to challenge this logic, though.
Okay, I'll go for it.
Because as a consumer, a watch is a totally discretionary accessory. You wear it if you want to track your steps or check your text messages, but you can take it off whenever you want. People wear glasses out of strict medical necessity. If they take them off, they can't drive, they can't read.
That's true.
Furthermore, glasses define your face. People are deeply emotionally attached to them for fashion and personal identity. And on the business side, the global optical market isn't a fragmented space. It is tightly controlled by the EssilorLuxottica monopoly.
Right, the giants.
They own Ray-Ban, Oakley, LensCrafters, Sunglass Hut, Pearle Vision. Can Apple really expect to disrupt a 100-year-old, fiercely protected optical monopoly just by slapping a Siri microphone and a tiny camera onto some plastic frames?
Well, that is exactly the $200 billion question Apple is wrestling with, and it's why they aren't going it alone. Reports indicate they are deeply engaged in partnership talks with brands like Warby Parker.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Apple understands that they cannot just release a clunky piece of hardware. It has to be a flawless piece of fashion first, and it has to handle complex prescription lenses without a hitch. But more importantly, as they try to integrate this tech onto your face, Apple is wielding a massive strategic weapon that Meta simply doesn't have.
Which is?
Their hard-earned reputation for privacy.
Right. That is the crucial differentiator.
Think about the mechanics of smart glasses. You are wearing outward-facing cameras and always listening microphones on your face, walking through public spaces, looking at your private documents, talking to your family.
It's a privacy nightmare waiting to happen.
Exactly. Meta has historically struggled immensely with consumer trust regarding data collection and advertising algorithms. People are naturally wary of giving Meta a literal POV feed of their lives.
Yeah, that would be.
But Apple, however, has spent the last decade building its entire brand identity around a privacy-first, on-device processing approach. If Apple can unequivocally guarantee to the consumer that the cameras on their face are solely for personal utility, like, you know, recognizing a landmark or translating a sign, and are not silently feeding their daily lives into a targeted advertising machine.
That changes everything.
That baseline of trust could be the deciding factor that finally pushes smart glasses into mainstream adoption.
Wow. So we've covered incredible ground today. What does this all actually mean for you, the listener, as you navigate this stuff? From Zero Axe Florent and the White Hat hackers cleaning up the messy blockchain code of 2016 to massive protocols like Alav and hardware giants like AMD getting incredibly pragmatic about how the real world actually functions. Right down to Samsung and Apple being forced to physically adapt their trillion-dollar ambitions to actually fit the reality of human faces and hands.
It means we are watching the tech industry mature in real time. The era of building technology purely for technology's sake, you know, of chasing numbers on a chart just to say you did, is fading.
Thank God.
The companies and protocols that are succeeding in 2026 are the ones focusing on thoughtful, secure, and deeply user-centric integration, Whether you are actively investing your capital in DeFi platforms, choosing which gaming monitor to put on your desk, or deciding if you're ever going to buy a pair of smart glasses, understanding these underlying strategic shifts is vital.
It really is.
It helps you see clearly past the polished marketing hype, allowing you to recognize what is actually going to provide you with secure, long-term value.
Absolutely. And I want to leave you with one final, perhaps slightly unsettling thought to mull over as you go about your day. We started this deep dive by talking about the Av hack. That hack proved how incredibly vulnerable interconnected digital systems are to bad actors who forge credentials and manipulate the surrounding environment.
Right, the RPC poisoning.
Exactly. Now think about Apple and Meta racing to put cameras and AI-driven microphones directly onto our faces. If an entire DeFi ecosystem can be completely manipulated to mint $230 million out of thin air just by spoofing a digital bridge's data feed, what happens in 5 years when our interconnected wearable systems devices that literally see and hear our physical reality all day long face their own invisible integer overflow moment?
Oh, man.
If a hacker can poison the data feed of a blockchain, what happens when they can poison the augmented data feed of the glasses sitting on your nose? How secure is the ecosystem of your own physical life?
That is a deeply fascinating and honestly necessary question to end on.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the Taken Night Reports. Keep questioning the tech around you, and we'll catch you on the next one.